Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Second half, one-on-one with author and scientist Bjorn Lomborg. Bjorn is a guy who's called like a climate change denier, but he's really just a super thoughtful guy with tons of information. So listen, and I think you might change your mind about some of the stuff that's going on today from an environmental standpoint. Again, very thoughtful conversation and a lot to learn with Bjorn. First, I'll tell you about LifeLock. Turbulent times out there. Cyber criminals love that, man. Send in emails, including Black Lives Matter and the subject lines, to install malware called TrickBot on victims' computers. Important, very important to understand how cybercrime and identity theft are affecting our lives every day. We put our info at risk on the internet. You could miss certain identity threats by just monitoring your credit. LifeLock, the leader in identity theft protection, detects a wide range of identity threats like your Social Security and a number for sale out on the dark web. Protect yourself. Use the industry standard. That's LifeLock, and protect your identity with LifeLock. Right, Dawson?
No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses. LifeLock can see threats you might miss on your own. Join now and save up to 25% off your first year by using promo code Adam. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK or head to LifeLock.com. Use promo code Adam for 25% off.
It's time to check Adam's voicemail.
Adam, hey, brother. Just got through watching your Danny Trejo interview. You have been knocking it out of the park. Jason Whitlock, Randy Rainbow, D.L. Hughley, Sean Penn, Travis Pastrana. Oh, my God. Just awesome.
You can leave us a message at 888-634-1744.
Well, we're going to keep the streak alive with Bjorn Lomborg, who's got his book out. We spoke to him a couple of months ago, and we stayed off of this subject until the book was released, and it is now released, available on Amazon. It's called False Alarm: How Climate Change Panic Cost Us Trillions, Hurts the Poor, and Fails to Fix the Planet. Good to speak to you again, my friend.
It's great to be back.
So before we get into the specifics of your book, and if you disagree, disagree, I feel like we're entering a period in on this planet where we're finally able to have honest conversations about things without being called the denier, or you hate your grandchildren, or being sort of just tarred and feathered, and or racist, or like a whatever. Like we're finally getting to some sort of saturation point where we're able to say, look, we all want the same thing. We all love our children. We all love the planet. Might we have a sensible conversation?
I would love to be in that place. My sense is actually the opposite, that over the last couple of years, there's been ever more sense of panic on the climate change front. And as more and more people believe, this really is the end of the world. Look, there's a recent survey that showed that almost half of the world's population now believes that global warming is likely to mean the extinction of the human race. When you think that kind of thing, people get very, very antsy about anyone questioning anything you're going to do. So my sense is actually why we definitely should have that open conversation, because we're talking about spending lots and lots of resources. We should talk about, are we doing that well? I feel like we often are being told, no, you can't have that conversation. There's only one right answer. It's the end of the world. We need to throw everything in the kitchen sink at this.
Well, let me reframe that a little bit and say, maybe it's my perception that there are more outlets for people like you. There used to just be a mainstream media, and if you had an opinion that differed with theirs, then you were not welcome. And now there's so many different outlets now that there are places that welcome a voice like your voice.
And that's true. And that is both, thank you very much for having me on, but also I think that is crucial for us as a civilization to actually get all of our challenges right. If we don't talk about this, how the hell are we actually going to make good decisions?
Right. So we agree, or you agree, that the globe is where there's warming, and that it's caused by man. So it's not a yes. It's not a denier sort of situation. It's there is warming. It is being caused by man. And the question is how do we go about remedying this, or how do we go about diminishing the negative effects as much as we can? Like for and there's technologies that we're not aware of. I've said, you know, many times when I was growing up, you and I are the same age. I grew up with, you know, the internal combustion engine is going to destroy the atmosphere. But then somebody came up with a catalytic converter and many other things. And what's coming out of the tailpipe of a car? When I was a kid, if somebody started their car in their garage and you walked in the garage, you couldn't breathe. You couldn't see your hand in front of your face. I can run my car in my garage now with the door shut and you can't even tell. I mean, that's it's the same internal combustion engine.
Don't do that at home, though.
I won't. But it's the same engine. It's the same internal combustion engine with so much technology that is so much cleaner now. So there's... There's that. Let's focus on potential technologies.
Yes. If I could just add just before, because you just said, you know, look, I totally accept global warming is happening and it's man-made and we should do something about it. I also mostly use the UN climate panel, the gold standard of understanding what is up and down. So this is not a conversation about, oh, there are these murky websites that we should visit and think about. This is the exact stuff that everybody agrees on, but we don't have the conversation on how do we smartly tackle these problems. So when you talk about technology, we are simply not at a place where we can dramatically change over to low or zero carbon technology. Right now, it would cost us a fortune, which, of course, is why we've spent, you know, $5 trillion in subsidies to solar and wind over the last 10, 20 years. And we have tried really, really hard. And still, we're only at about a little more than 1% of global energy comes from solar and wind. So we need something else that is going to be much cheaper and much more effective if we're actually going to convince most of the world to switch over. So technology is absolutely the answer. You were never going to tell people, don't drive. What you could tell them is get a catalytic converter so your car doesn't pollute. And that's indeed what we all did.
Well, I think sort of the disconnect is once people couch it as a life and death situation, then they say it doesn't matter how much it costs, or it doesn't matter how difficult it would be to implement this technology. It doesn't matter because we're going to die, so we have to do everything. And the problem with that is if you have a technology that is clean and it's efficient, but it can't be utilized in, you know, China or India or parts of the third world or whatever, if it's not going to be used, well, then who cares how clean it is if it's not being utilized? If people are still burning wood and coal or dung or wherever they are, well, then who cares hypothetically or from a technological standpoint what a breakthrough you have if the world isn't using it?
Exactly. So I think you just nailed in the head two points. One, we need to confront the climate panic, because if we think this is the end of the world, we're unlikely to do anything but say, let's throw everything in the kitchen sink at this. And we're unlikely to listen to rational argument because, as you just pointed out, we need to spend everything. We just got to do everything we can. The second part is, unless we can get the rest of the world along, this is not a discussion about well-meaning rich people in the US and Europe and other places to switch a little bit of their energy supply to more green energy. That's all nice, but it's not really going to make a big difference. It is about making sure that everyone, the Chinese, the Indians, Africa, Latin America, everybody else will actually join in. And that only happens if we have technology that's actually sufficiently cheap. We need to have both of those conversations, and I'm glad we're having it today.
I am too. And, you know, the United States kind of has this world revolves around us. And I think a lot of that is because art and a lot of entertainment, sports, you know, we're sort of taste makers. You know, you want to be, our movie stars are the biggest movie stars. Like, I'm from the United States. And if somebody goes, this guy's the biggest star in China, I go, eh, that's sweet. Yeah. We got Brad Pitt. We got real stars over here. You know, like, we feel that way kind of about everything. And I think that sort of narcissism sort of bleeds over into global warming. Like, we keep going, we got to clean up our act. We got to get 100% solar. It's like, we don't represent enough of the planet to change things if we can't get India and Africa and Russia and China. If we can't get them on board, then what is this one? But it's a very kind of, it's kind of an ugly American thing. And I don't know, does Sweden sort of have that sort of holier than thou kind of thing as well?
There's definitely some holier than thou, but I think they know that they're not the whole world. And we still watch Brad Pitt and all the others. So I think we're much more into understanding that there's a lot of other big players out there. But you're absolutely right. Unless we can get everybody on board to do this, we're not actually solving anything. We have this idea that we can just virtue signaling our way to this. No, I mean, that's going to make us feel good, but it's not actually going to solve anything for our descendants. And I don't think our descendants are going to judge us on how well we felt. They're going to judge us on how well we actually did.
Right. So, you know, when I grew up, there was a lot of discussions about, you know, how dirty the rivers were and how polluted the air was. And I grew up in Los Angeles. We had, you know, 80 smog days a year in Los Angeles with a population. And now listen, kids, don't check me on this, but I'm just going to make it up. You know, we had 3 million people living in the Los Angeles basin, and we had 80 smog days a year in 1974. And now we have 10 million people and one smog day a year, or no smog days a year. So how did we do this? So many more cars, so many more human beings. Well, we did it with technology. And the rivers were a mess, too. It was like, oh, the rivers. And we cleaned up a lot of rivers. Like, we're pretty good at using technology to clean things up and to make things work. And so anyway, sorry, thoughts on that subject?
Well, and I think we also need to recognize that it stems from you being rich. If you're rich, you can afford to fix many problems. If you're poor, you simply have much more urgent needs, like making sure your kids don't die tonight, or getting enough food, or, you know, get a job, or get education. So the reality here is, if we want to fix climate, we also have to recognize that for the vast majority of humanity, this is about getting them out of poverty. This is about getting them a life that's actually worth living, so that they can get to the point where they actually start saying, look, I'd like to have less indoor air pollution. I'd like to have less outdoor air pollution. I'd like to have our rivers clean. And then eventually also, I'd like to not emit so much CO2.
It's funny, because all the years I work construction out here in Los Angeles, and I would work with a lot of poor Latin guys. And when they were done at lunch, they'd finish off their Coke cans and they'd go right into the garbage can. And I would go, in the recycling, put them in the recycling bin. And they'd go like, yeah, all right. Mm-hmm. And then the next day they'd throw, and I'd go, you got to recycle. And I realized that's not important to them. It just isn't. You have to get to a station in life where that's a kind of a first world problem, where you can really sweat and wring your hands over the Coke can going into the wrong bin. In their world, it's much more about survival than it is about these. These are problems that one day, God willing, you'll get to, but they're not the kind of problems that most of the world thinks of now. And we look at everything through our lens. So we're like, why don't you just recycle? Or why are you burning coal or wood? Why don't you use renewables? And it's like, because they're not there yet. And we can't expect them to be there yet. So what are some of the things, you know, I heard you talking on Dennis Prager's show earlier today about nuclear, which I like, but you were explaining that it's cost prohibitive because of the cost of actually building a facility?
So nuclear obviously is a great technology for providing 24/7 power. It actually gives you backup power, unlike solar and wind. You can count it all the time. It is surprisingly very, very safe. So, you know, people think that this is really terrible, but no, it's actually one of the safest energy sources. Yes, there's Chernobyl. Yes, there's Fukushima. They kill very, very few people. And remember, most other energy technologies kill far more people and on a very regular basis. The problem with nuclear right now is that it's fairly costly. The nuclear power that you already have, because we've already paid for the power station, you should just run as long as you possibly can, because it's incredibly cheap power you get from existing nuclear power plants. So you should not close down nuclear power plants. That's incredibly dumb. But building new ones turn out to take a long time. They typically run vastly over cost. And so the total cost of actually getting power from nuclear power stations is about 2 to 3 times what it costs from fossil fuels and also from some of the cheapest solar and wind. So the idea here is you need to remember, unless we can innovate the price of nuclear down, and we should, and you know, Bill Gates and many other smart people are trying to do so, we are not going to be able to solve the climate crisis with nuclear.
Well, nuclear is one of those things, and it kind of, it's part and parcel of what you're talking about, which is let's have a discussion about energy and about the environment, but let's not assign a bunch of negative or positive traits to one form or another. You know, out here, some idiot in 1974 coined the phrase no nukes, and now we decided we were done with nuclear power because some asshole said no nukes. That's literally how dumb we can be. And when we decided that we liked solar farms, got the word farm and sun in it. So solar farm sounds good. Windmill, that sounds good. Okay, that's good. Nuclear, no nukes. And the first things, let's just remove all the stigma and all the baggage and all the theatrics from it and really just drill down on what is the most effective and would has the smallest carbon footprint. And I guess that is nuclear, but now we're years away from building new facilities and the cost is incredible.
Yeah. And so fundamentally, we can only get to this conversation if we stop the panic. That's why that's the first subline of my book. You know, climate change panic is costing us trillions. We need to stop this panic. How do you do that? Well, if you look at what the UN climate panel actually tells us, it tells us that by 2070, so about 50 years from now, the net impact of climate change, if we do nothing, is equivalent to making us somewhere between 0.2 and 2% less well off. It's like deducting 0.2 to 2% of your income. Remember, by 2070s, you're going to be much richer. Well, you and I probably aren't because we're not going to be around, but people like us and our kids are going to be much richer. On average, we expect kids or people and by then, on average or across the world, to be 2.63 times richer. So what they're really telling us is instead of being 2.63 times richer, it'll feel slightly less. We'll only be 2.56 times richer. And that sort of puts it in context. This is not the end of the world, as many people are telling us. This means we'll be slightly less, much richer in 2075. That's a very different way of approaching it. And this is not me saying it. This is the UN climate panel telling us what is up and down here.
Well, how I'm always curious. It's sort of like I wrote a book as well, and there was a couple of pages in that book, which is recently out as well, which is they've been telling us that, you know, 1 in 5 women would be sexually assaulted on a college campus. And my question then is, why are you saving up for college for your 12-year-old daughter if, in fact, you believe that? And what I'm starting to realize is I don't think they believe a lot of the stuff they're saying. I grew up with a hippie mom in the 70s. It's, we're going to have to live underground. There's going to be an ice age. We're going to be out of food. I've been hearing this since I was 7 years old in the 70s about the world is going to end, ice age, famine, out of food, living underground. It's never happened. Then there's AOC. There's Al Gore in between. There's AOC now. Do they believe it's going to happen, or are they saying it to, like you talk to a child, you know, do your homework. The boogeyman's under the bed. If you don't do your homework, the boogeyman's going to get, because I know what's best for you because I'm smarter than you.
There's probably a little bit of both, but my sense is, I mean, I've debated a lot of these people, and I think they really believe this is an existential crisis. If you talk yourself into this, and if you start looking out on the world and you hear one news story after the other telling you this is the end of the world, then clearly you will sort of get this confirmation bias and you'll say, yeah, it really is going to come to an end. And so, therefore, we need to do everything. But just to, you know, I actually go through a lot of these stories and show you how it comes that you hear a little bit of truth and a lot of exaggeration. So last year, Washington Post and many, many other papers across the country and the world had the story that 187 million people are going to have to move because of sea level rise by the end of the century. And you know, some even went further and said they're all going to drown, those 187 million people. How did they get to that? Well, they said sea levels are going to rise because of global warming. That's absolutely true. And then they said all of these people are going to do nothing. They're just going to sit there and watch the waves lap up over their knees and eventually, you know, they'll drown in 80 years. And of course, that's not actually what happens. So the paper that looked at the 187 million also said, what will happen if people do sensible adaptation? Turns out that instead of 187 million people being flooded, it was 305,000 people that were going to be flooded by the end of the century. Remember, 305,000 people is half the number of people that move out of California every year. Of course, we can handle that move in the world over 80 years. So they were 600 times exaggerated, but it makes you scared when you hear that story. And of course, the newspapers are going to run with the 187 million rather than the 300,000. So you hear the scary story. These people believe this is the end of the world. And so I think a lot of them really believe we got to do something and we got to do something now. And then, of course, once their deadline run out, as they often have, they'll have a new one and say, now this is the deadline. And if we don't get it done, we're all going to die.
Well, it's kind of the atheist rapture, right? Like most yes. these, we're not talking about Christians or Catholics here. I mean, these are atheists and this is their version of the rapture, which I understand there's a part of our brain, evidently as human beings, that is carved out for some rapture thought. And there's a religious version, and this is the New York Times version of the rapture. The seas shall reclaim the earth. And as you were talking about it, you're talking about technology, and I've heard you talk about, you know, man and innovation and stuff. And I was thinking, well, wait a minute. Don't we know this? Because New Orleans is below sea level. We had seawalls that were built. They were not kept up to code. The Army Corps of Engineers kind of let them slide into disrepair. Then Katrina rolled around and kind of jumped the wall. And I'm oversimplifying this, but if those walls were looked after and maintained and the Corps of Engineers did their due diligence, then we wouldn't have flooded. I mean, we have places that are below sea level and we use technology and building and construction to stave off nature.
Of course. Look, Holland, 40% of Holland is below sea level. The world's 14th largest airport, Amsterdam Airport, is below sea level. It's actually the only airport, as they like to advertise on their website, the only airport that's built on a former site for a Navy battle. But yeah, so the fundamental point is we know how to fix this when we were much poorer and had much less technology. Of course, we're going to fix this today. And there's something wrong with the argument of saying all of these things are going to happen and nothing but climate is going to change. No, humans are actually going to adapt. Again, this does not mean that there's no problem. Climate change is a problem, but it's not the catastrophe that you that many people like to sell, because we are able to adapt.
Is there, for instance, and if you disagree with any of this, please correct me, but many people I know now have fled California. They've moved to Arizona. Arizona used to be a little too, wasn't hospitable enough for human beings. Like, you know, just got too damn hot. And before, everyone had air conditioning in their cars and air conditioning central air in their homes and, you know, misters on their patios that spread water, spread out vapor, water mist, and cooled them outside and recirculating and, you know, going out to a movie theater with the air and the mall with the air and stuff. And now you can live quite nicely in an environment that, hey, in the 50s, in the 40s, in the 30s, you couldn't live there. I mean, it was too tough to live there. And I think the growth in population has proven that. So we've solved with technology. We've taken a place that wasn't really inhabitable and we've made it habitable. Is that exactly accurate?
And not only is it accurate, it also shows you how we're going to solve most problems. You know, so clearly, you know, one of the things that a lot of people worry about is as temperatures rise, we're going to have a lot of negative impacts because it's worse when it's really, really hot. That's true. But we, for most places, fix this technologically exactly with air conditioning. So while everybody focuses on heat, obviously that's the big problem with climate change, we have to remember that the vast majority of people actually die from cold. A big study in The Lancet a couple of years ago showed that every time one person die from heat, 17 people die from cold. And so from moderate temperature rises, it's likely that that you'll actually see more people having benefits because they'll stop dying from cold.
All right, hold the phone. Let me tell you about some technology that I like. Tushy. That's right. This ad's for you. You got a butthole? I bet you do. Then this ad is for you for years, bidets. They've been available, but they're too expensive. So I say hello to Tushy. Cleans your butt, and it's got a precise stream of fresh water for just $79. Attaches to your existing toilet. No electricity or extra plumbing. Cuts toilet paper use by 80%, so no more hoarding over there. And you may not even have to wipe at all. A little dab and dry will do you. Even the best at 2-ply can't beat the hands-free poop experience with Tushy. Every Hello Tushy bidet attachment comes with a 60-day risk-free guarantee and a 12-month warranty. Join millions of happy Hello Tushy customers now and have a clean butt with every flush. It's Tushy, right, Dawson?
Go to HelloTushy.com/Adam to get 10% off. This is a special offer for our listeners. Go to HelloTushy.com/Adam for 10% off. HelloTushy.com/Adam.
So, Bjorn, sorry. Technologies or any... Or what is out there that we're not aware of or that my listeners may not be aware of that you think is promising?
So there's a lot of promising technologies. So clearly we should have batteries for solar and wind, because the real problem is not getting solar when the sun is shining or wind when the wind is blowing, but is what are you going to do when the sun is not shining or the wind is not blowing? We need much more batteries and we need them much cheaper. Just to give you a sense of the size, right now the U.S. has enough battery power to store the average electricity used in the U.S. for 17 seconds. So clearly, we're nowhere near what we need to get. Likewise, we talked about nuclear earlier. If we could innovate the fourth generation nuclear to be much cheaper than fossil fuels, that'd be amazing. That's what Gates and many others are trying to do. They're trying to make these very simple, basically nuclear power plants you can build on assembly lines. You can assemble them like Legos and you can put them up and they're very safe. That would be amazing. But again, it requires a lot more research. There are lots and lots of other great ideas, and I outline a lot of them in my book, but let me just give you one of them. So the idea that we could actually capture CO2 from the atmosphere. So, you know, the big problem is that we emit a lot of CO2 when we use all our fossil fuels. Imagine if we could just go along doing that and then capture it again from the air and store it as rocks, for instance. If we could do that really cheaply, we would basically be done. We can't right now, but if we innovate that, possibly we could make this a very cheap and manageable challenge. And then, of course, the world would actually have fixed climate change.
Well, so
there are lots of technologies.
Sorry, capturing CO2 and storage of CO2, how would that work?
So the idea, it's a little bit what trees do right now. Trees take up CO2 and grow big, but we just can't do it because there's not enough land on the planet. But what you could do is essentially have scrubbers of the atmosphere. They'd just be standing out in the open, taking in the atmosphere, which has a little bit of CO2, and scrub out the CO2. That's the hard part because it's very, very few molecules you need to get out. And then you have them react in some way and store them in something either just deep underground. Ironically, you could store it in gas chambers. So first we take out the gas and then you store the CO2 down there. Or you could store it as rocks, that is inert stuff. There's lots of different proposals for how to do that. But basically, the idea would be that we take out the CO2 that we pumped into the atmosphere, and then we don't have a climate problem.
Where are you with hydrogen as it pertains to like automobiles?
So hydrogen is one of those solutions that we've heard for a long time. It basically, if we could produce it with wind power and then use it in our cars, we would basically have a closed loop that wouldn't emit CO2. The problem is hydrogen is really hard to store. It's pretty dangerous and it's fairly costly to make the transition. So it's one of those things that maybe it'll happen, but there's a lot of arguments why it probably won't. But again, the whole idea here is to recognize if we have lots and lots of ideas, we don't have to make that decision. We simply fund all those researchers, go crazy on all these different ideas because that's really, really cheap. And then we just need one or a few of those technologies to actually work. And those are the ways that we're going to power the 21st century.
What about biodiesel, algae, things of that nature?
So algae might actually be a really good idea. So Craig Venter, the guy who cracked the human genome back in 2000, he's working on this algae that you can put up on the ocean surface and grow oil. So it would take up sunlight and CO2, and then we put it in our tanks and burn it and emit the same CO2. So it'd be CO2 neutral. It's not commercially viable right now, but if he could magically make it much better, that'd be cool. Then we could go on living as we did before. We'd have lots of oil and it would be CO2 free. With biodiesel, that unfortunately requires a lot of land because basically you take corn in the US or you take some other crop, you grow it, and that takes up space that you could otherwise have used for making food. That drives up food prices. You also use up a lot of land that otherwise could be used for nature, and you require a lot of land to just replace part of the U.S. infrastructure. So it is something that a lot of people use because it's very easy and it's cheap and it makes it feel like you're doing a lot of good for the environment. But the reality is it's probably not the main part that you're going to do for solving climate.
Where do you think we're going to be with electric car technology? And everyone thinks it's kind of free, but there's a lot of heavy metals and a lot of batteries and a lot of things that we're going to have to deal with down the line. So it's not really free. But what's your thoughts on electric cars and their environmental impact?
So a lot of people talk about the batteries and how we don't have enough resources for that. I think we've shown pretty convincingly that if you want to do something, you can actually do that fairly easily. Of course, we can get those raw materials. It's going to take a lot of effort. And yes, it's not going to be free, but we can certainly do that. But I think we have no sense of how little the impact on electric cars are actually going to be. So the International Energy Agency estimates that if we manage by 2030 to get about 300 million electric cars in the world. Remember, that would be an amazing feat. Right now, we have about 5 million. So that would be an incredible increase. That would still only reduce global emissions of CO2 by 0.1%. So this is a very, very small thing. And unfortunately, right now, electric cars are mainly, you know, playthings for rich people. They're fairly expensive, and we subsidize them enormously because it makes people feel good, but they actually cut fairly little CO2. So to give you a sense, in California, you probably subsidize an electric car to the tune of about $10,000. Plus, of course, you give them right to go in the high occupancy lane. What is it called?
Diamond Lane. Yeah. HOV.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And, you know, you get free parking and you get, you know, free recharging and all that stuff. So it's a subsidy to rich people. How much good does it do? Well, if you look at the amount of CO2 it reduces, you could have reduced that on one of the trading systems, for instance, the Reggie in the Northwest US, and it would have cost you $50. So you spend $10,000 on cutting the same amount of CO2 that you could have done for just $50. That's a bad deal. Electric cars are going to come. We should definitely encourage them. We shouldn't be spending $10,000 right now. We should wait 10 years and have everyone buy them because they're good.
I'm sorry. Did you say trading deal? I was unclear.
Sorry. So for instance, there's many places. Europe has a big trading system, but where you basically say to a lot of different power plants, for instance, you can only emit this much. And so they have to find a way to adjust that. And then you buy permits to emit your emissions. What this means is that you essentially have a trading place where you can go in and say, I can buy an extra ton of CO2. I can buy that reduction here. And somebody will magically make that happen by, you know, using a little less coal and a little more gas or that kind of thing. So you can do that in the most cost-effective way. That's right. What they do, for instance, in the Reggie in the Northeast. And so the idea is you could go on that market and basically force them to cut 10 tons of CO2. That's what your electric car will do over a decade, but you could do that for about $50. If you can do it for $50, why would you spend $10,000 to achieve the same?
Well, the electric car is, we're very, I guess, and I don't know what it's like in Sweden, but for us, everything is symbolic. You know, we like to do a lot of virtue signaling. And so celebrities who could drive around in Rolls Royces drive around in Priuses. And then we get on everyone's case for flying privately and not flying on Southwest Airlines. And we do a lot of sort of symbolic stuff. But we're very symbolically oriented just for everything, for Black Lives Matter to everything else down. It's like a lot of gestures and symbolism and not a lot of action or actual getting stuff done. So it's like, you know, the mayor is painting Black Lives Matter on the streets and five blocks away, some black kid's getting shot. That's kind of how we do it as a country. I don't know if you guys do it. So symbolically.
There's a lot of that. And of course, there's two negative parts about that as well. If you drive around in your Tesla and feel really virtuous, we know from research that that means you also feel more okay to do something unvirtuous. You know, you've sort of on the plus column. So now you can go, you know, you can take a trip to Mexico kind of thing. And then of course you blow your entire emission reduction. The second thing is just remember, environmentalists constantly tell us, you know, fly a little less, drive a little less, do with a little less, you know, don't drive to work all the time. We just did that. That's what Corona has done for the whole world. So we've just had that incredible shutdown around the world. Remember, China almost entirely shut down in March, but we know how much that actually saved. At the most shutdown day in China, they still emitted 78% of their CO2. Because you still have to live, you still have to heat your house, you still have to do a lot of other stuff. So actually, even if we manage to get everyone to stop driving, everyone to stop flying, all this other stuff, we would only cut a little bit. There's one guy who, a climate scientist, who estimated how much will the total shutdown of the world actually matter by 2100. And the answer is, first of all, you won't be able to measure it, but on the models, you will have reduced temperatures by 1/500th. Of a degree Fahrenheit.
Right.
So we got to recognize this is not about you and me doing a little bit. By all means, do that. But this is not what's going to solve the problem. That's technology.
Well, what if it's not? So we live here, and look, not only am I in the United States, not only am I in California, I'm in Hollywood. So it's a constant beating of a drum of like, you got a ride share and then take your electric car and recycle your Gatorade bottle. And it's like, it all feels like, you know, just window dressing. And it is, but people do it anyway. And it kind of feels good. And it feels like you're doing something when nothing is getting done. But if it's not automobiles, where does the lion's share of the CO2 gases come from? Where, what would be the most impactful thing we could do in terms of reduction of that?
Well, I think sector? The point from, sorry. Yeah, I think the point is exactly we can't do very much. Now, people will argue you should go vegetarian, but actually, if you look at it, you know, meat emits a lot of CO2. I'm a vegetarian, by the way. But, you know, if you cut your meat production, it also means that your food is cheaper. So you will spend your money on other things that emit CO2. We actually know that the right answer is going vegetarian will probably cut about 2% of your emissions, or the equivalent of about $3 in the Reggie. You know, you could eat all the meat you like and pay $3 and you would have achieved the same emission reduction. If you look at flying, sure, if you actually cut a lot of flying, you could reduce your emissions significantly for you. But remember, most of the rest of the world wants to get flying, and it has lots and lots of great benefits. Again, I think we need to recognize we're never going to solve problems by telling people, I'm sorry, could you do with less? What you do fix problems with is coming up with better technologies. Can I just give you an example? Back from in the 1860s, we used whales to basically harvest them for oil, because the oil from whales burnt really, really cleanly, really, really brightly. So it was used all across Western Europe and North America as the best kind of way to light your home. And that's why we started hunting the whales to extinction. The solution to hunting whales to extinction wasn't to tell everyone, I'm sorry, could you turn down the lights? Could you go back to camp for oil and all the soot in your ceiling? The solution, of course, was, here's a better technology that'll provide all the stuff you like, but cheaper and more effectively. And that was petroleum when we found oil in Pennsylvania in 1862. Suddenly, you get a much better technology, much cheaper, and then people stop hunting whales. The same idea goes today. Don't try to tell people, I'm sorry, do with less. Be sorry. Don't do this. It's always ever going to be, as you say, window dressing. The right way to do this is through technology. If we could come up with cheap fourth generation nuclear power that'll outcompete fossil fuels, everyone will switch. If we could come up with incredibly cheap solar plus batteries, everyone will switch, and so on. So it's really down to technology. You're not going to get people to do with less, but you will make them do with smarter.
Well, I can tell you through sort of anecdotal experience of flying model airplanes, it's going to take a second, but it's going to make sense. 20 years ago, they first came out with like electric model airplanes, and the battery pack was a brick. I mean, it was literally, if you wanted to fly a ducted fan, that was kind of a poor man's jet airplane, had a fan in the middle of it. It's what it was. It was a ducted fan airplane. You had this brick of what was like C-cell batteries, and you'd have to daisy chain them, and there'd be a brick of maybe eight or nine of them. And if you could picture eight or nine C-cell batteries shrink wrapped, and picture the heft of that in your hand, and then picture trying to fly that thing, it would be very difficult. Electric model airplanes used to account for almost nothing in terms of the amount you'd see out there for the modelers and the people that were hobbyists. And now I feel like it's more than 50% of the market, because the batteries got lighter and more powerful. And people aren't good or evil. It's just if you can fly that model airplane and do it efficiently and not have to go out there with fuel and a starter and smell the fumes and hear the noise and the expense and so on and so forth, then you'll happily do it. You won't do it if it's not going to be efficient. You will do it if technology. So technology caught up to electric model planes, and now most people happily fly their electric model planes because the batteries got smaller and lighter in a pretty short period of time. I mean, it went from unrealistic in the year 2000 to, oh, why wouldn't you do it 10 years later? It wouldn't, didn't even make sense not to use electric.
Yeah, and that's exactly the same kind of dramatic and transformational innovation we need for society. But again, also, let's just remember the size of what we're talking about. I mentioned before that you have right now battery power to store 17 seconds of US average electricity. We need to dramatically ramp that up so that you can actually store energy across not just a sunless night or a windless week, but basically over seasons. And that's going to take a lot more. So we're not very close to this, but we should certainly try to become much, much closer to it.
Is the battery technology moving at that kind of clip? Again, I'm just going from the basic electric airplane model from 1999 to 2002 today, where it's now totally feasible in a 15 or 20 year span. Do you think we're going to progress that quickly over the next 15 or 20 years as well?
Again, I'm not a material scientist, so I just rely on people who tell us we're going to do much better. But even if we do much better, we will still have a very, very long way to go. So batteries are still going to be much, much lacking behind actually being able to have a totally solar and wind powered society, which is why we really need breakthroughs. So it's not just about making the ion battery, lithium ion battery, cheaper and more effective. It really is about finding a different way to do this. And again, who knows? I think if you look at any one technology, it is very unlikely that we can just throw a lot of money at it and get it. But the point is, if we look at 100 different technologies and throw money at it, and because you need to throw fairly little money at each one of them, we just need one of them to come through. And that's the real trick, to realize this is not ridiculous if you just try to do it across a wide range of areas. But we need to not get wedded to this one technology. One of the things I think is really bad in the whole climate conversation is everyone has their own favorite technology. You know, then it was hydrogen. Very often it'll just be solar and wind, and that's the only thing that you can talk about. There's lots of different technologies. Let's try all of them and see which one works best.
Do the AOCs or the Greta Thunbergs of the world or many, many others. I mean, I think there used to be, and you would know better than I, but I think maybe it was the Los Angeles Times, that's the biggest newspaper in Los Angeles, the newspaper record where I live and grew up. They said, we're not going to print any articles that disagree with basically what Al Gore and Greta Thunberg and AOC are saying. Like, if you have a thought that differs from our thought in terms of global warming, we won't recognize you. That seems insane for a newspaper that labeled people like you dangerous. Is that still in effect? And how is it for you, who sort of lived in the middle of this for such a long period of time? Do you feel as unwelcome in that community as you ever did, or do you feel like in many? I'll keep going for a second here and tell you what's going on in the United States. Is we have editors from the New York Times resigning. We have folks in positions saying, I'm not going along with this anymore. I'm not going to keep going down this road. We have to be able to have a dialogue. This cancel culture is not, I don't want to be a part of it. I'm a liberal. I didn't get into journalism to cancel people. I got into journalism to hear opposing viewpoints. I know you were sort of a marked man in this community because you disagreed with the status quo, which was doom and gloom. Have you felt the winds change at all, or are you still a pariah?
I'm certainly somewhat of a pariah. I think I'm less so because I'm not actually disagreeing with the UN climate panel. I'm using their numbers. But as you point out, it's not just about that. It's also that my points are inconvenient. They're uncomfortable. This is not what we usually want to hear kind of thing. It doesn't support the easy new Green New Deal. So what I've found is that, and that's reflective of what you just said, that in the U.S., it has become increasingly hard to have anything but the same viewpoint represented over and over again. So I used to be able to write easily in the Washington Post or New York Times, and that's become harder and harder, not because I've changed, but simply because they have become more isolated as I see it. That is a shame for everyone, because at the end of the day, this has to be about how do we do smart policy based on reasonable analysis? And that's what I try to present with my book. And I think that's what most people want to hear about. So in that sense, it's become harder, but it's not impossible. And, you know, we still do some things with the Los Angeles Times, and we try to get out in all these areas. And I think there's some sense in which people recognize, look, we're trying to solve a really big problem. Maybe we shouldn't shut out all the people who doesn't say there's just this one thing that works. Because just remember this. For the last 30 years, we've been trying one way of trying to fix climate change, which is, if you will, a little bit the Al Gore approach. We promise lots of stuff, and then we mostly don't do it. And not surprisingly, that hasn't worked. And I'm surprised that people who are really, really worried about global warming say, let's keep doing that. I would suggest that if it hasn't worked for the last 30 years, maybe we should try and find another and better policy. That is one that is not going to cost as much, that will have much greater chance of working, and that will have a much greater opportunity to actually fix climate change. And that is, as we've talked about the whole time, technology. Invest dramatically more in technology. And if you saw what, you know, Biden just came out with his $2 trillion plan, lots of things that are, you know, really questionable. And I think a lot of them are just going to lose money. But he did do one thing. He also said, let's invest a lot more money in green R&D. And that is wonderful. So at least, you know, there's some push in the right direction.
Last couple of questions, because I know it's at midnight where you are. And so a couple things. You brought up Inconvenient Truth and Al Gore. That movie is 15 years, 18 years. How old is that movie? 15 years old now?
14, yeah.
And many of the prognostications didn't come to fruition or not. I really haven't studied it.
Well, I mean, he didn't make all that many short-term predictions, so it's hard to say that, but he certainly made a lot of exaggerations. And, you know, he did say in combination with his movie, I believe in 2007, that if we haven't fixed climate change in the next 10 years, it's going to be too late. So, you know, that was 2017, and clearly it isn't. So, again, it shows a little bit the problem of making these promises. The next 10 years, or we're all going to be doomed. Well, no.
A lot of smart people I've spoken to, including yourself, seem to, and his history has bore this out, technology, we're pretty good at fixing things with technology, even if we don't know what it is now. Again, like we didn't know what a catalytic converter was in 1956, but we've done a pretty damn good job at fixing things. I mean, look at medicine, for the love of Christ. Like, we are pretty good at fixing problems, even problems we create with technology. And I think it's safe to say that you believe we'll go down that same path as it pertains to the environment.
I think it's the only way that we can go down. Whether we actually choose that is obviously up to us. I think there's both a risk that we're going to spend all of our money on subsidizing existing inefficient solar and wind, feel good about it, and actually not fix climate change. I also think there's a big risk that we're not going to spend very much on research and development. Then, of course, we're not going to get many innovations. So we really need to get people back to realizing The only way you can fix this in the long run is by dramatically increasing investment in green energy R&D.
Last question. I know you're a nice guy, but how much of this feels like folks in charge wanting to tell you what to do? A lot of this feels a little bit punitive or something. Like it's almost as like they're partially interested in the environment and wholly interested in sort of dictating your life to you. That's kind of what it smacks of to me. Do you feel there's a strong element of that?
I certainly think there's a strong element of something else. When you look at politicians, yes, they like to fix the planet and their country and do good and all that stuff, but mostly they want to get reelected. And one of the ways that we have shown throughout time is for a politician to be able to say, you are doomed. You are going down the drain, but I can save you. Vote for me and I will save you. And climate change gives you the extreme opportunity to do that. Not only to actually say, I'm going to save you, vote for me, but also I'm going to save you and the costs are going to come in the next election cycle. That's the perfect setup for politicians. So I think a lot of politicians more or less have just simply jumped on this because it's such an easy thing to say. So all these terrible things, I can save you, vote for me. And I think that's what politicians are doing. And in that sense, of course, it's not very helpful because they're basically saying, vote for me to spend your money badly so that we can talk about this next election cycle as well.
Well, Bjorn Lomborg, are you a false alarm, by the way, how climate change panic costs us trillions, hurts the poor and fails to fix the planet? Is this book being reviewed? Is it going to get up at the New York Times bestseller list? I've noticed, but believe me, I'm in the business of saying things that are unpopular as well. And there's two modes I've noticed. It's either they attack you or they shun you. So it's either they attack you for what you're saying, or they just pretend like you were never born, like as if you never came out with a book or came out with a movie. There's no reviews. There's no discussion. Usually it's a compliment when they just ignore you because that means you're right and they don't want to have to deal with you or your product is good. But is this thing being reviewed? Is it going to get on the New York Times bestseller list? Is the LA Times going to review this book?
They certainly should, and you should tell them. So New York Times actually just came out with a review, a scathing review.
What?
So in some sense, I guess I should be pleased that they actually, bothered to review the book. They asked George Stiglitz, to review it, they honestly admitted on Twitter, that they asked him and he said, yes, I'll review it, but I'm going to give it a terrible review. Before he read it. And it seems like he never really bothered to read very much of it. He basically just enforced the standard view. He said a lot of wrong things. He told us that Wall Street is going to be flooded by 2100, forgetting that it's already flooded today, as in flooded. But of course, the pedestrians that walk around there don't actually need scuba gear because technology saves Wall Street and will also, of course, save Wall Street in 2100. So there is these kinds of reviews. There is also some great reviews out there. But yes, there are definitely some people who would like to silence this book.
Do you notice the theme with the bad review from the New York Times is they give the book a bad review, but they don't refute the technology or don't refute the information that's in it? I've noticed they say it's a bad book, and then you go, all right, tell me everything I got wrong, and they don't address that. They just say you got it wrong.
They go even further. They say it's a dangerous book.
All right.
And then you know where they're headed. And also, curiously, they mostly pan me for using the Nobel laureate, who actually won the Nobel Prize in climate economics, for saying stuff that's inconvenient. Well, there you go. I tend to think that the guy who actually got the Nobel Prize for talking about it probably knows his stuff and probably has a point and certainly should be heard and certainly shouldn't be silenced in the New York Times. But look, they're not going to silence us. And what they're actually saying is this is dangerous because if we start this conversation, we're not going to have an easy journey with the new Green Deal. And of course, at the end of the day, if you want to spend a lot of money, you don't want that to be too scrutinized. But I would tend to say, if you're going to spend trillions of my dollars, I want to have a say, and I want to notice that all of that money is spent well.
Well, keep on doing the Lord's work, even though you're probably an atheist.
Or at least not that religious, right? I mean,
in Scandinavia. Vegetarian, I know where you guys I know how you guys roll. Bjorn Lomborg, thank you for joining us once again. Get some sleep.
Wonderful to be on your show.
Thanks for staying up late. And again, the book, False Alarm. You get it. You read it. You decide. Available on Amazon as we speak. Thank you, Bjorn. All right. Let me hit Simply Safe up here first. Number one sign of a bad home security system. It's complicated. And you never use it. Simply Safe. Simply, well, it's simple and it's faster. Designed to be easy to use while protecting your whole home 24/7. Order online, open the box, place the sensors, plug it in. No technician or salesperson will come to disrupt your house. No outrageous monthly fees or long-term contracts. We use it here. I've always used these guys. It's up and running in under an hour, peel and stick. The sensors are small. You don't even really see them. I mean, it looks like the ones that are hardwired. And you don't have to drill. You don't have to pull wires. Batteries last up to 10 years. There's some battery technology for you. Just take the home unit. You plug it in. Name the best overall home security of 2020 by U.S. and World Report. Right, Dawson?
Head to simplysafe.com/Adam and get a free HD camera for our listeners. That's simplysafe.com/Adam to make sure they know you that our show sent you.
All right. Good Sports is coming up next, and you can go to adamcarolla.com for all your live shows, and you can get my book, I'm Your Emotional Support Animal. That's up and running on Amazon. Get Bjorn's book, then go ahead and get my book. Live shows coming up Addison, Texas, I think the 24th, 25th, or something like that, then back to Texas again for some other date somewhere, sometime. San Antonio coming up July 31st through August 1st, and Addison Improv July 24th, 25th. Tempe coming up. Go to AdamCarolla.com. Find all the live shows. Till next time, Adam Carolla for Gina Gradden, Paul Bryan, and Bjorn Lomborg. Saying mahalo.
Stick around. Dave Damashek and Adam Carolla return with Good Sports next.
Podcast One Sports Network presents Good Sports.
Hi and hello, sports fans. Welcome to the Friday edition of Good Sports. Dave Damashek here, Adam Carolla over there. Yesterday, a hearty breakdown of the state of fruit at the midway point just passed in 2020. Ace, let's talk about some real sports, shall we? And the NFL's announcement last week to, at least for 2020, end the jersey swap. Too dangerous in the age of 19. How say you?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
With the, you know, there's so much spittle and so many guys getting in each other's faces and so much contact.
That's why it's funny. That's what the players are going crazy. Like, wait, what? We're going to bang heads for 3 hours, but we shouldn't give each other our shirts after?
Yeah. Right. Again, probably just something symbolic. You know, to say no to, because you got to act like you're doing something. I mean, obviously, I don't know if anyone's ever thought about anything over the person's face. I'm not talking about a mask. I'm talking about a little plexi where the mouth is, because it seems like there's a lot of grunting and huffing and blowing. And you know, if you ever listen to Mic'd Up, whenever you listen to Mic'd Up, it's one big, you know, like screaming in other people's faces.
Yeah, right.
and everything. And if in fact this thing is transmitted by the spittle that's in the air, first off, interior linemen, I mean, it's unavoidable. Everyone's down in a 3-point
stance. I think those
stance.
Are legitimately, as they talk about what the plans are, and, well, these guys are all in supreme condition, and so therefore they should you know, probably not suffer any serious health stuff. But it's, but like we've talked about before, offensive linemen in the NFL, almost all of those guys are carrying like a phony 70, 80 pounds. They have to inflate themselves to play at that level. And you see like 6 months or a year after they retire, it's like, wait, that's the same guy from the 300-pound guy? How did he lose all that weight? It's because it's easy for them to lose because it's phony weight. You would think guys that are falsely obese like that are going to be susceptible to it. But yeah, anyway, it's a funny thing that they would get. By the way, the jersey swap, I never liked it anyway.
No.
The pro football could learn a thing or two from WWF or WWE, in my opinion. Some, you know, a little villainy would be good. We talked on Wednesday about changing the Redskins' name. Maybe they should just change it. They should just be like the Darth Vaders or something like that. Would it kill an NFL team to be the heel? You know, to just be like the bad guys of the league? People always like that stuff.
We grew up with, you know, Jack Tatum. They call me assassin and all the, you know, the Steel Curtain and and all these guys and these legendary kind of Night Train Lane and these sort of bad boys of the league and the Raiders at the time. And the, again, like the Jack Tatum and the, and the,
what you get a documentary out of it. At least look, Kimmel and Cousin Sal are now producing the 86 Mets documentary. And that they stand out because they were bad boys. So too do the bad boys themselves, the Detroit Pistons. They get stuff made about them too. The Oakland Raiders are the stuff of nostalgia and they're iconoclasts specifically because they were bad guys. I think a team should really embrace this. The Philadelphia Flyers haven't won a Stanley Cup since 75, but everybody knows they're the Broad Street Bullies, and that's their entire ID. Maybe there's some value to positioning yourself as a bad boy and refusing to change jerseys. Slug a guy from the other team if he offers to trade jerseys with you, I say.
Or do the jersey swap, then wipe your ass with it and light it on fire on the 50-yard line.
That's what I'm talking about. Thank you. You get it.
Oh, you know my move. You know what the bad boy move is? The bad boy move is we do the move your own Mean Joe Green did, where we got the jersey and we're walking out of the stadium and there's the poor inner city kid and he hands you the Coke and you chug it and then you pretend to throw the jersey to him. You just wipe your brow with it and walk in to the. And then he goes, the poor kid who handed you the Coke after you just chugged the whole Coke. He goes, but I thought I was going to get the jersey. And you go, yeah, you can get the jersey. And he goes, where? And you go, on eBay, bitch, like everyone else. And you walk into the locker room. I'll put a buy it now price on there for you.
Yeah, I mean, listen, yeah, listen, get creative, have fun with it, drop it right in front of you and say, hey, you can have this jersey, come get it. And then when he's walking over to you, you start peeing on it, you know, like that.
Yeah.
It's all yours. Take it. I thought you want it so bad.
That's right. You know?
That's a move. I think football fans would get behind this. No more of this. We're pals. No one wants to hear that you're friends.
And then we got to get rid of the prayer circle too. But players from each team taking a knee, getting in a circle. This is nonsense.
Worship your God if you want. And you know, maybe you never see Jewish guys doing that because there have been three Jewish guys in the league in the history of the league, maybe. That's actually, I don't think that's true. There have been a nice little uptick in my brethren in pro sports in the last decade or two. But yes, a little actual disgust. I mean, that's what made, for real, that's what made the 70s so much fun. You knew that the Steelers and Cowboys didn't like each other. You knew that the Raiders and Steelers didn't like each other, that the Raiders and Dolphins were arch enemies with each other. Nah, it's too much grab ass after the game and before the game, too. Hey, good luck out there. No good luck.
Look no further than, you know, the last few Super Bowls, like, you know, Kansas City, San Francisco. There's no bad blood. Nobody hated each other on each other's team. You didn't hear about, there's no love lost between these two great rivals. You know, never hear any of that stuff. I used to hear there's no love lost.
I still never understood it, but I got the spirit of it. What the literal meaning of no love lost?
I don't know, but believe you me, they did
lost.
It.
Hey, Ace, before we end up the week here, I wanted to thank you for one of your great life tidbit advice for life tidbits. I now am 2 for 2, and with both my young sons, Jean-Claude Van Damashek, now a half dozen years at least ago, did this, and now my little boy, Hoover Damashek, did the same thing. He's 5 years old. Caught me. He was gonna take a shower, and I said, "Oh, you can come in after me." And I got out of the shower nude. He saw me, yeah. And what did he say? He say, "Dad, you got a big weenie."
Right, and he'll carry He'll carry that for the rest of his life.
Jean-Claude Van Damashek, many years ago, but I still remember it like it was yesterday when I came out of the shower and he said, Dad, your weenie is huge, you know?
It's important.
So I'm 2 for 2, and I think that now I have two sons who presumably are going to have some good self-esteem when they talk with their peer group in high school. Like, my old man, when he hangs brain, look out, you know?
Well, but here's a very important caveat. You can never let them see you again. Like if you're going camping you're taking a leak off in the woods, you know why? It'll be the same thing with your dick that happens to swimming pools. I literally had this talk with my son the other day. Like he went, our old house when I was like 5, he said, I thought the pool was huge. I said, nah, it wasn't that big. It wasn't that big. My grandmother had a little pool. I thought it was a big pool. You know, once you see that pool again as an adult, you're like, God, this was so huge when I was 9. Now it's miniature. So the same thing that'll happen with grandma's pool will happen with your chode if you ever let your child see it again. And that's concerning to me.
And that's one to grow on. All right. I mean, we could press on, but I don't see the point. I think you've said it all now. I wanted to talk hot dog eating contest, and I have a new game for you. But you know what? That'll keep till next week. One quick, Ace. Because you and I have talked about this in the past, not sports related. But it's always weird when the media doesn't tell you an important detail, because I know you're big on specifics, that's a big thing. Like, what are the specifics? In this Mary Trump book about Donald Trump, she alleges that Trump, on the night that his brother died, he had a heart attack and they were summoned him to the hospital. He instead, Donald, went to see a movie. And then nobody said, like, well, what movie? I think it's weird that nobody asked. So I looked it up. These are the movies that were in the theater that would have been available. Which did he see? Body Heat, French Lieutenant's Woman, The Evil Dead, Das Boot, or Mommy Dearest?
I'm going with Body Heat, I think. Based on the other interview I heard with the friend of the woman who wrote the book, who is speaking on her behalf, because the woman who wrote it has a gag order, that when she was like 29 and showed up at Mar-a-Lago, like poolside, Trump like looked up and went, wow, you're stacked. And
he probably said, I got to go see this Body Heat. That Kathleen Turner's stacked.
That's right. Probably that's what I'm basing it on.
All right. Good times, Ace, as always. We'll be back with some more hot sports talk for you. Until then, for Adam Carolla, Dave Damashek, good sports out. Good sports.
Follow the Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow Ace on Twitter at Adam Carolla. You can leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744. Be sure and get Adam's book. I'm your emotional support animal. It's awesome and available everywhere. Get the links at adamcarolla.com.